accusations that Iran gave Russia ballistic missiles for use against Ukraine.
Given all their destabilizing activities, that's a dangerous outcome.
Another presidential debate in the U.S. This time it's Kamala Harris and Donald Trump on stage.
They have two jobs. One is to get people who are undecided to vote for them. But beyond that, they want to make sure that the people who say they're going to vote for them actually show up and vote.
And
no, I am the father.
James Earl Jones, the actor who voiced Darth Vader, has died at the age of 93.
Search your feelings, you know it to be true.
Today is Tuesday, September 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
We're prepared to deliver significant consequences.
U.S. State Department spokesperson Vedant Patel commenting on reports that Iran has transferred ballistic missiles to Russia for use against Ukraine.
Any transfer of Iranian ballistic missiles to Russia would represent a dramatic escalation in Iran's support for Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine.
The European Union spokesperson described the information as credible that Iran has given short-range ballistic missiles to Russia. Nasser Kanani, Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman, saying, "We've clearly stated that we're not a part of the war or the conflict in Ukraine." That's Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov, who says, "Iran is an important partner. They're developing cooperation and dialogue in all possible areas, including the most sensitive ones." White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby.
I cannot confirm the reports that the transfer has happened, but I would point you to what we have said in the past, that any such provision of that kind of technology would not only have a deleterious effect on the Ukrainians' ability to continue to defend themselves and certainly on the lives and livelihoods of Ukrainians, but could, depending on what the deal, how it's consummated, have equally deleterious effects on the Middle East.
Ukraine's foreign ministry said on Monday it had summoned a senior Iranian diplomat to warn of, quote, devastating and irreparable consequences, unquote, for bilateral relations if the reports were true. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says it's unrealistic to think the UN could play a role in Gaza's future, saying it's unlikely Israel would accept a UN role.
Of course, we would be ready to do whatever the international community asks for us. The question is whether the parties would accept it, and in particular, whether Israel would accept it.
He said the UN has offered to monitor any ceasefire in Gaza and once again demanded an end to the fighting.
The ceasefire is an absolute must. As I said, the level of suffering we are witnessing in Gaza is unprecedented in my mandate as Secretary General of the United Nations. I've never seen such a level of death and destruction as we are seeing in Gaza in the last few months.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his government have accused the UN of being anti-Israel and have been highly critical of UN humanitarian operations in Gaza. Israel has remained silent on strikes in Syria, the deadliest attacks on Syria since the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus was hit in April. We'll get details on this part of the story now from Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
Charred remains of a vehicle and blackened, smoking earth marked the aftermath of what the Syrian government on Monday said were Israeli airstrikes the night before. Syria's health minister said the attacks killed at least 18 people and wounded dozens of others. Syrian state news agency Sana showed images of what it said were those wounded getting treatment. It cited a military source that Syrian air defenses had shot down some of the missiles. Two regional intelligence sources said a major military research center for chemical arms had been hit several times. They said it was believed to house a team of Iranian military experts involved in weapons production. There was no immediate comment from Israel, which typically remains silent on reports of strikes in Syria. Israel has for years been targeting what it described as Iranian or Iran-backed targets in Syria. It has stepped up the campaign since the October 7th Hamas-led assault on Israel from Gaza, after which Iranian-backed Hezbollah fighters began firing rockets into Israel from Lebanon. A residential building in northern Israel was hit by a projectile on Monday after air raid sirens blared across the border town of Nahariya. Israeli media reported the building was hit by a drone launched from Lebanon. The strikes came a day after Israel's defense minister Yoav Gallant visited troops in Gaza City, telling them, quote, "We are preparing for anything that can happen in the north." And saying that they could be redeployed on a short schedule.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. Still ahead, previewing Tuesday's debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
At least 30% of Americans, they're not sure who she is or what she's all about. Whereas that's true for fewer than 10% of Americans with Donald Trump.
We're following these other stories from around the world. SpaceX will launch its first uncrewed Starship to Mars in 2 years when the next Earth-Mars transfer window opens up. Elon Musk said in a post on X that if those landings go well, they will launch the first human flights to Mars in 4 years. British Foreign Secretary David Lammy will host U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in London on Tuesday. Discussions will include support for Ukraine and the de-escalation of violence in the Middle East. Apple on Monday charged into the artificial intelligence craze with a new iPhone lineup that marks the company's latest attempt to latch onto a technology trend and transform it into a cultural phenomenon. 4 different iPhone 16 models will all come equipped with a special chip needed to power an AI suite that Apple is hoping will reverse a recent slump in sales. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump square off Tuesday in Philadelphia for their first presidential debate. Analysts say this rhetorical slugfest, which pits a prosecutorial puncher against one of America's best-known counter-punchers, could be decisive as they vie for the presidency. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
In the Republican corner, former President Donald Trump, trying to reclaim the title after a 4-year break. And in the Democrat corner, Vice President Kamala Harris, the rising challenger who has Americans wondering whether she can go the distance to the Oval Office. Tuesday evening's presidential debate, with its glossy production values, pre-event taunts, and starkly different contenders, feels like a heavyweight bout. Trump's last debate ended with a knockout. Just weeks after President Joe Biden's lackluster late June debate performance against Trump, Biden announced he would not seek re-election. Now, with Harris just weeks into running as his replacement, she faces Trump on the debate stage. But analysts say it's more than a spectacle. This toe-to-toe contest, where both will vie for points from a deeply split electorate, could be decisive. They bring very different styles to the stage. Trump has jabbed at Harris's intelligence and predicts that his odds against her are better than against his last debate opponent, Biden.
He is a smarter person than she is. Oh, they're waiting for the debate.
And here's Harris taking a short break from debate training.
Look, it's time to turn the page on the divisiveness. It's time to bring our country together. Chart a new way forward.
June's Trump-Biden debate drew more than 51 million U.S. television viewers. Analysts expect big numbers for this matchup, too, and high stakes for both contenders. Nate French teaches communications at Wake Forest University.
Trump has to prove that he can be president, and he has to prove to a lot of the people who are looking at him that he can be as assertive and as aggressive as he wants to be without being rude, if he's going to try to get anybody that might not be currently on the Trump train. Kamala Harris has to prove that she's presidential. She has to prove that she can attack and she can pull back. She has to prove that she can identify where her policies are different than Biden, but still moving in the same Democratic platform.
Moderators will pepper the candidates with questions on major issues like the economy, reproductive rights, foreign policy, and more. Each candidate, given only a pen, paper, and water, has 2 minutes to reply. Jeremy Suri is a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin.
To some extent, the debates give the two candidates a pass because they can state the things they want to do, their aspirations, without having to explain how they will do them. But where it becomes significant is they have to at least say, when they articulate their positions, what they think that will look like.
It all happens in Philadelphia on Tuesday night. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
So let's dig into this. Joining us now to talk about the debate is Kami Akhavan. He's the former CEO of ProCon.org, a website of nonpartisan research on controversial issues, and now leads the Center for Political Future at the University of Southern California. Well, thank you so much for being able to do this.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
So what are we looking at here? What do both candidates have to do in this debate? Let's start with the one we know, Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is a known quantity to most Americans. So he's going to have to, one, excite his base. They already know they're going to vote for him, or say they will. He needs to make sure they actually show up and vote with enthusiasm. So he needs to excite his base, and he needs to convince anybody, and it's a smaller number of people who are still not quite sure who to vote for, that he's the better candidate. He has been convicted of various crimes, and he knows what the arguments are against him. So he's going to have to shore up his defenses and show that he's the stronger candidate, and that the trials against him were indeed misguided and politically motivated. So he's going to make that argument. He's going to make the argument that our borders are unsafe and that Kamala Harris had something to do with that and didn't. He's going to make the argument that the U.S. pullout and withdrawal from Afghanistan was a disaster and that Kamala Harris had something to do with it. He's going to try to show that she is unfit for office and he is, of course, qualified for a second term. So we'll have to do all of that within a 90-minute period where most people have already made up their minds about Donald Trump and whether they plan to vote for him or not.
And a lot of those issues don't resonate with people. What does he have to do demeanor-wise? Because that is really what we're looking at here on this debate, the two of them standing next to each other.
Well, demeanor-wise, he is going to do what he is not capable of doing anything besides, and that's being Donald Trump. So he's going to be tough. He's going to ask pointed questions. He's going to try to interrupt and disrupt. He's going to counterattack. And he's going to stick to a lot of his favorite messages about Kamala Harris and how she had all this time to try to implement the reforms that she's now advocating. So why didn't she do it? If you listen to strategists, he's going to have to appeal more to suburban women. He's going to have to draw voters from the Black and Hispanic communities. And so a lot of his messaging is going to be focused on the economic issues that transcend these other sorts of demographics. And really, the economy is the number one issue on people's minds. You know, how much of what they bring home in their paycheck and how far is that going? You know, is it enough to cover all the various expenses, their mortgage, their rents, their groceries, their gas, their childcare? Which candidate can speak to the fact that there will be less pain when they get paid and that their money can go farther?
All right. Now, Kamala Harris, despite the fact that she's been the Attorney General of California and the Vice President of the United States and now the candidate for presidency, a lot of people don't know a lot about her. So this is going to be their first look at her in this context. What does she need to do in this debate?
It's a great question because Kamala Harris has been vice president for almost 4 years. Kamala Harris was celebrated with great pomp and circumstance at the Democratic National Committee, where she quickly ascended to the party's top spot. And yet for about at least 30% of Americans, they're not sure who she is or what she's all about, whereas that's true for fewer than 10% of Americans with Donald Trump. So her case is going to have to be explaining who she is and what she stands for and why the candidate Kamala Harris is the one that deserves to be the first ever female president, first ever president of Asian heritage. And she's going to have to show that she is tough on these issues and sort of shore up any perceived weaknesses she has as a candidate, and that maybe she's too liberal and that she's too soft on crime. Well, she's a prosecutor, so she'll have to show she's tough on crime, and she's been tough on border issues and tough on immigration. So she'll have to do all that while trying to appear like a nice, normal human being, right? One that cooks, as she's been doing in recent videos, and one who can connect with people and identify with people and find them, people can relate to her. as a person. So she's going to try to be likable as well as tough, and define herself in opposition to Donald Trump. That point of distinction is quite clear, or should be quite clear, especially after this debate. But she's also going to have to distinguish herself from Joe Biden, who a lot of centrists still would have held their nose and voted for, but don't really like. They think a lot of the economic problems have a lot to do with Biden. And so she's going to have to show she's a different kind of candidate, one who supports Biden, but also has different ideas and policies that will make the economy stronger and better for most Americans.
Now, I'm going to step out on the ledge because I'm going to talk about conventional wisdom, and nothing about this campaign is conventional.
Fair.
But so theoretically, Ipsos places undecideds at about 10% and says really only half of them are going to vote. Is that who these two are talking to, or are they talking to a broader audience because of the unusual nature of this campaign?
Well, they have two jobs. One is to get people who are undecided to vote for them. So in that sense, yes, they are appealing to undecideds. But there's far fewer undecideds remaining in this country for them to target. So they're surgically thinking, how do I appeal to those undecided voters in especially the six or seven battleground states where the vote will really, really matter? But beyond that, they want to make sure that the people who say they're going to vote for them actually show up and vote. I mean, some states are going to have early voting that opens within about 5 weeks. Now, that means that the window of opportunity for these candidates is diminishing to settle people's minds. So how do they get folks excited to show up and vote and guarantee that they're going to show up and vote? And that is where you look at some other sorts of demographics, you know, those who are not just say they plan to vote, but those who have a voting plan. And when you look at that kind of polling, there's greater enthusiasm currently on the Kamala Harris side. Some of that has to do with the fact that, well, the Democrats convention was more recent and the level of excitement is higher. But what they call this honeymoon period seems to be waning. And now the latest national polls have both candidates within a point or two of each other, basically within the margin of error. So it's really going to be an even heat from this point forward. And it's going to be the enthusiasm battle that's going to carry the day.
The get out the vote.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for the time and the insight.
Oh, you're super welcome. I'm such a fan of Voice of America. I appreciate this very much.
That's so nice of you to say. Kami Akhavan from the Center for the Political Future at the University of Southern California. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Kenya has begun 3 days of national mourning following the death of at least 21 students in a boarding school fire in the central part of the country. Authorities say 17 children are still unaccounted for as parents line up for DNA testing to identify bodies burned beyond recognition. Juma Majanga reports from the VOA Africa News Center in Nairobi.
Distraught parents and relatives gathered to give samples for DNA testing Monday at the Naromoro Hostel in central Kenya. John Mwangi said he still does not know the whereabouts of his child, a student at the school.
It is to be a reprieve to 20 parents. I might be among them. I don't know. That's why we are here. So we are hanging on hope.
Kenyan authorities say the inferno broke out Thursday in a dormitory housing 156 students, the majority of whom escaped. However, some of the 21 killed were burned beyond recognition. Officials say 17 children remain unaccounted. Officials have yet to determine the cause of the fire, with investigations still ongoing. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
The United Nations Security Council is expected to vote Wednesday on whether or not to renew existing sanctions that prevent the transfer of military equipment to Sudan's western Darfur region. The pending vote comes as Human Rights Watch calls on the council to expand the arms embargo to the rest of the country. Mohammad Yusuf has more.
Ahead of Wednesday's vote, Human Rights Watch is urging the council to consider imposing an arms ban on the entire country to stop the ongoing rights violation and the suffering of the people. The Sudanese government opposes the expansion of the embargo. Jean-Baptiste Golopa is a senior researcher in Human Rights Watch Crisis, Conflict and Arms Division.
We based our research on an analysis of photos and videos posted on social medias and primarily taken by the fighters themselves, showing them in possession and using equipment such as attack drones, drone jammers, anti-tank guided missiles, as well as truck-mounted multiple rocket launcher systems and mortar munitions.
The rights group's report shows that some of the mortars fired were manufactured in China last year. Companies in Iran, Russia, Serbia and the United Arab Emirates have also produced some of the weapons used, according to the organization. Mohammed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. prosecutors unveiled criminal charges on Monday against two alleged leaders of a white supremacist gang, saying they used the Telegram social media site to solicit attacks on Black, Jewish, LGBTQ people and immigrants, aiming to incite a race war.
The defendant's goal, the indictment charges, was to ignite a race war, accelerate the collapse of what they viewed as an irreparably corrupt government, and bring about a white ethno state.
That's Assistant Attorney General of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, Kristen Clark.
This indictment reflects the department's response to the new technological face of white supremacist violence, as those seeking mass violence expand their reach online to encourage, solicit, and facilitate terrorist activities.
The group, dubbed the Terrorgram Collective, used the site to celebrate white supremacist attacks around the world and solicit racially motivated violence, according to prosecutors in the indictment, which was unsealed in federal court in Sacramento, California.
You can't escape accountability by hiding behind a computer screen.
The pair also collaborated on a list of high-value targets for assassination that included a sitting U.S. senator and a U.S. federal judge. And finally,
no, I am the father.
James Earl Jones, the actor, the voice, the icon on stage and screen, has passed away at the age of 93.
Simba, you have forgotten me.
No, how could I?
You have forgotten who you are, and so forgotten me.
The Lion King.
Ray, people will come, Ray.
They'll come to Iowa for reasons they can't even fathom.
Field of Dreams.
This is CNN.
Even the voice of CNN. Believe it or not, Jones was a lifelong stutterer. He wrote in his autobiography that as a child he was too embarrassed to speak and remained virtually mute for years, communicating with teachers and fellow students with handwritten notes, till a sympathetic high school teacher learned that he had written poetry and demanded that he read one of his poems aloud in class. He did so flawlessly. Jones made his Broadway debut in 1958, won two Tony Awards, and appeared in many iconic films, Dr. Strangelove, Conan the Barbarian, The Hunt for Red October, Patriot Games. His agent, Barry McPherson, confirmed Jones died Monday morning at his home in New York's Hudson Valley, and the cause was not immediately clear. James Earl Jones, dead at 93. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.